Hey, it's Luke Black, proud owner of The Marketplace. Since 1980, we've been your neighborhood sandwich shop. We're open Monday through Saturday for breakfast and lunch. If you're craving a fresh sandwich, salad, soup, or a hot cup of local roasted coffee, we've got it all made fresh daily. The Marketplace can cater your next event from small office lunches to full wedding parties. You can rent our space for private gatherings after hours. You can find The Marketplace at 246 Olmsted Boulevard in Pinehurst. It's not just a sandwich, it's an experience.
This is Taking Aim, a weekly show hosted by David Hensley and Stephen Woodward. Join us for open season on hypocrisy, deception, woke culture, and uniparty cronies. We'll review the stories you might have missed and prepare you for what's to come in the week ahead. Taking Aim starts right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to your favorite Saturday morning radio program, heard exclusively here on WEEB. This is Taking Aim, and I am Steve Woodward. Thanks for joining us, and we've got a very jam-packed show full of content, full of all kinds drama and intrigue, and some political hijinks as well. We always begin by acknowledging our faithful and beloved sponsor, The Marketplace, restaurant and catering since 1980, your go-to for fabulous breakfast and lunch opportunities, and all of the catering needs you will ever have, from intimate office gatherings to the wedding of the century. And I would be remiss if I did not add that beginning on April 1st, which is coming up in the coming week, dinner will be served at The Marketplace Mondays through Thursday, 4 to 8 p.m. And you can come in and order any of their two combos for just $20. So that's dinner at The Marketplace beginning April 1st, Monday through Thursday, 4 to 8 p.m. So that'll give you one more opportunity to enter the doors of The Marketplace over there off of Highway 211. Coming up, I want to remind you that we will have a special guest this morning lending his insights to the program. He is Andrew Dunn. He is the author of the Longleaf Politics newsletter and also a recurring political columnist for the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer. Andrew is a very credible writer and columnist on all manner of North Carolina political topics. He's been following it for a number of years now, and we're going to talk about the demise of longtime state Senate President Phil Berger, who in one primary season has gone from being the overlord of the North Carolina State Senate to a nothing burger after his stunning primary defeat. And Andrew is going to tell us how that happened and where we go from here. Okay, you're on the edge of your seats because we're going to tell you the winner of this week's dubious distinction, public enemy numero uno, number one. Public enemy number one, the way we lead off each and every edition of Taking Aim. It falls to a gentleman named Joe Kent. Who's Joe Kent? He's not Clark Kent, that's for sure. Joe Kent is a Washington State political figure. He has run at least once, and I'm thinking more than once, for a congressional seat out of Washington State. He is a military veteran. He endured the deep sorrow of losing his spouse to her military service a number of years ago. She lost her life wearing the uniform for this country. And Joe, for many years, was someone you would see on some of these political podcasts weighing in from the western part of the country, you know, a Republican in a very blue state. And when Trump was reelected, and was putting his cabinet together, Joe Kent was named director of National Counterintelligence. Pretty big job, pretty important job. And a lot of folks said, yeah, that's a great job for Joe Kent. He's a patriot. He's, you know, ex-U.S. military. He's been in sort of this realm for many years. And so, you know, life goes on. The cabinet positions are named. They come in, they're confirmed, and they go about their work. And then we really don't hear from them very much. But Joe Kent decided to become a headliner, and in my estimation, public enemy number one. He abruptly resigned his position in the last couple of weeks with a letter to President Trump saying that he could no longer fulfill the duties of Director of National Counterterrorism because he fundamentally opposes U.S. military intervention in Iran. And he didn't leave it at that. He went on to say that he thinks it reflects the fact that the United States is a vessel of the state of Israel and is merely doing its bidding for Israel in Iran and in taking out the Iranian regime. Of course, many people found that to be a preposterous statement from a member of the Trump cabinet. And if he felt that way, why did he wait until after we had blown the leadership of Iran into smithereens to come forward and in a very disruptive manner resign his post? Good question, you could say. Very good question. But, you know, Joe Kent wasn't done yet. Now he's linking the assassination of Charlie Kirk last September to Kirk's occasional criticism of Israel and the United States' long-standing relations with Israel. A very well-known investigative reporter named Michael Schellenberger did a deep dive into that story as it applies to Joe Kent and Charlie Kirk. We have a couple of clips. Let's start with clip one.
Joe Kent, of course, the former director of the National Counterterrorism Center, you know, has been saying for the last week that he thinks that that he doesn't buy the lone shooter theory of the assassination of Charlie Kirk. He suspects there's a foreign nexus, was the words he used, involved in that assassination. He said that the FBI prevented him from investigating it and that he viewed that as suspicious. And if there was nothing there, he told me, then why did they prevent him from investigating it? I asked him if he was aware before he went public last week that Tyler Robinson, the suspected assassin of Charlie Kirk, that his defense attorneys might actually call Kent to the witness stand to argue that that Robinson could not be convicted because the prosecutors had not given them all the information they had available to them. That's something known as the Brady Rule, named after a Supreme Court decision, I believe in the 1960s. But nonetheless, most people are familiar with it from television, which is that the prosecutors can't deny, federal government can't deny, the government can't deny the defense any information. And Kent is saying that there is information and that the investigation itself was inadequate. And that, you know, I spoke to a constitutional legal scholar yesterday who said, you know, it would be a no-brainer for the defense attorneys now for Robinson to use Kent's statements as a way to, you know, gain an advantage or potentially a hung jury or a mistrial or something of that nature. So it's pretty serious for people that are interested in seeing justice served with the assassination of Charlie Kirk.
Here's what I want everybody to know. Shortly after Tyler Robinson's arrest, the prosecutors released a probable cause affidavit detailing the evidence gathered immediately after Charlie's assassination. The evidence presented at that time was overwhelming. But people also need to remember this. In the months that have followed, we know the investigation has continued. More details will come out in May when the assassin has a probable cause hearing, and we are certain there will be even more evidence submitted against Tyler Robinson by the state. And that's so the frustration here, Michael, is that we have this vacuum, this void that's been created where the investigation is kind of still ongoing. They're still gathering it, getting it presentable for this May probable cause hearing. But the internet never stops. And Joe Kent resigned when he did, and now he's doing this PR tour. And it really does, and I want to get this through the audience's head, this really does have a potential to not only taint a jury pool, but to undermine the very prosecution of Tyler Robinson, who I am 100% convinced pulled the trigger and killed Charlie Kirk.
And of course, if you've ever had the misfortune of seeing the video of the moment when Charlie Kirk went down on that September morning in on the campus of Utah Valley University, it's pretty clear that one guy with a rifle did the assassination. But that being aside, you know, the wheels of justice will turn. And what Joe Kent has done here, it seems to me, is unnecessarily give the assassin's legal team a whole new avenue by which to defend their client and potentially absolve him of this heinous crime of assassinating a young patriot in his prime at the age of 31. So this story will continue to play out, and we shall see if in fact Joe Kent sticks to storyline that there's a connection between Israel and the murder of Charlie Kirk. There's always a runner-up for public enemy number one, and there's usually five or six of them, actually, because there's a lot of unhinged lunacy going on out there in this world. You've probably heard a lot in the past several days about yet another victim of unchecked illegal immigration in this country. The left considers it merely collateral damage, but we call it tragic murder. In this case, a young freshman at Loyola University, north of Chicago, a very small but rather lovely campus, not far from the shores of Lake Michigan. And the shores of Lake Michigan attracted this 18-year-old and her friends in the wee hours of March 19th, so after midnight. You could argue, hey, kids, you know, nothing good happens after midnight. But they were out strolling on a lovely evening, and they encountered an illegal immigrant from Venezuela, and he just decided to shoot her. Shot her right in the back, Sheridan Gordon, pronounced dead on the scene. And, of course, he's later arrested. And, by the way, he didn't get thrown in jail. He got sent to the hospital because he's suffering from a respiratory illness. I believe it's tuberculosis. So we're paying for his medical care as his punishment for killing a Loyola freshman. But here's the point of this story, and why we have found a second public enemy number one. She is the editor of the Loyola Phoenix campus newspaper, which, you know, as you might expect, dutifully reported that the young freshman had been murdered by this Venezuelan. And in their initial report, they parroted the phrase given to them by the Department of Homeland Security that Jose Medina is an illegal immigrant. And then, of course, I guess all the lefties and the politically correct crowd on the Loyola campus were up in arms, and they got to the newspaper editor, and here's what she posted in the form of a retraction, and I quote, "We describe the man who was charged as an illegal immigrant. That language does not align with the values of this newspaper. No human's existence is illegal. And we quickly changed our wording. We acknowledge the harm such language can cause." end quote. Okay, that sort of doesn't need a lot of embellishment, but I will say that obviously that is absolutely absurd that you are more concerned about harming psychologically illegal immigrants roaming the streets of Chicago and elsewhere than you are about the death of one of them at the hands of said illegal immigrant, the death of a student. So that's what you're getting, parents who are paying God knows what in tuition at Loyola. You're just developing a generation of Marxists. And by the way, you wonder why the media is so corrupt, the national media? Because they're spawned on campus newspapers all over the country, like the Loyola Phoenix. That's where they come from. They are being the next generation of corrupt media is, as we speak, being formed on these campuses. So, hey, hate to belabor the topic, but another add to the list, the Lakin Rileys and all these young women who've been murdered by illegal immigrants. Now we have Sheridan Gordon, and she will no longer be strolling the lakefront of Lake Michigan. We turn now to our other favorite award-winning sector of this show, public embarrassment, number one. a lot of fun determining the winner of this one every week, but I take it very seriously, and I consider it a very solemn responsibility. You know, it's been spring break season, and for whatever reason, some things never change, and these young college students are permitted by their parents, assuming their parents are even aware of what they're doing, to go to these beautiful beach destinations around the country and dress as scantily as possible and drink as much as possible. They are nearly naked and they are totally stupid and they are alarmingly vacuous. College students on spring break, they are a public embarrassment whether they know it or not. And we've got some beautiful clips here. Play the first clip, and then we'll come back and set up the second one.
Who won the Civil War?
England.
So England versus who in the Civil War?
France.
What continent are we on right now?
The US of A. What? Oh, my gosh, I'm getting clipped.
What year was 9/11?
2012.
Who bombed Pearl Harbor?
Spain.
So how many total senators does that mean we have in the United States?
Oh, 50 states, 3 times 50, 65.
What year did we free the slaves?
I should know this. This is a bad look.
1962.
Who is the commander-in-chief of the military?
Learned about this one at school, I think. It starts with a D. It's like donut or something.
Do you know what amendment freed the slaves?
We'll say the third.
First. What's the third amendment?
The right to bear arms.
Who played the Super Bowl halftime show?
Bad Bunny.
Who sings the song Espresso?
Oh, Sabrina Carpenter.
What does GRWM stand for on TikTok?
Get ready with me.
Who is Taylor Swift engaged to?
Travis Kelce.
Okay. Who sings the song Espresso?
Sabrina.
So you may have noticed that. So all the questions that are focused on current popular culture, like who Taylor Swift is marrying or married to, who performed at the halftime Super Bowl. They know those answers no matter how drunk they are, but they have no idea about, you know, the winner of the Civil War. And I think the guy, which by the way was the, you know, the Civil War took place in the United States. So I don't know. What was the answer? Spain? Anyway, the guy was trying to come up with the name of the commander-in-chief. I think he was trying to think of the acronym POTUS, President of the United States, but he came up with donut. The other clip is going to highlight the work of this young man named Johnny, who is becoming a star of the Jesse Waters primetime show on Fox News weeknights at 8 p.m., Johnny is sent out to do all these man on the street interviews to further expose just how really stupid so many Americans are and why they shouldn't be allowed to vote or drive automobiles. But in this case, Johnny is also sent to a beautiful spring break beach. Let's hear from Johnny.
You must be happy.
I'm very happy.
The Ayatollah's dead.
I'm so, what? Who? What? What is that?
Who the f*** is Ayatollah?
I've never heard that word in my life.
Lewis,
What's Ayatollah?
I haven't heard. I found out about Chuck Norris yesterday. That was more devastating to me.
He was the supreme leader of Iran.
He's dead?
Oh,
damn it. We killed him.
You did? You killed him?
Johnny. Whoa.
If you were in charge, how would you take on Iran?
Yeah, all my girls and we would all start putting belts on them.
We get a bunch of girls in bikinis, we make them run across the battlefield. All the guys are distracted, we all run in.
Look at him in his eyes, I guess. Just flirt with him.
I'd blow him up.
I don't know enough about it, but I would probably wipe it out.
Drop a bomb, baby. Bomb the out of him.
What have you heard about Venezuela?
Venezuela? Nothing.
I'm not sure.
I barely know what be going on in like Tennessee where I'm from.
That they beat us in the World Baseball Classic.
Have you heard anything else?
No.
Nothing. I have heard nothing about Venezuela.
You know, honestly, I don't know and I don't care.
Where is Venezuela?
I don't know. I'm drunk. I don't know. Venezuela? Isn't that in Spain?
Spain keeps popping up as an answer to these questions. It's interesting. Maybe they ought to try going to spring break in Spain next year and see how that goes for them. We can laugh at that, but, you know, let's keep in mind that most of these young college students have parents, and let's not blame the college students for their vacuous existences. Let's put the emphasis on their very AWOL parents, mom and dad. Get with the program. Sometimes these kids go to spring break and they don't come back, and that's, you know, when things get really dangerous. But I don't think I ever was allowed to go away to spring break when I was in college. My parents were paying for my college tuition, and so they set the rules. I think I was pretty much expected to come home and sit around the house, which is what I did. And I wasn't wearing a swim trunks while I was doing it either, I can assure you of that, or drinking beer, for that matter. So we laugh at these vacuous, mostly naked young people. But unfortunately, some of them are worse off than that. They're mentally unhinged. They are gripped by Trump derangement syndrome. And some of them are so determined to spew their hatred for fellow Americans, especially those who are members of the MAGA movement and supporters of the Trump rejuvenation of our country, that they are willing to go on social media platforms such as TikTok and say some very alarming things that probably ought to get them a visit from local law enforcement or the FBI. Let's hear from this crazed young woman named Alyssa Haas. Play clip 4.
Count your days, presidential party. If I see any one of you and I know who you are, I'm not going to have to say it out loud. I know. If I see any one of you and I have a loaded shotgun, I'm putting it between your eyes. It starts with Trump first, obviously, and then it goes down the line of power. So if any of you guys are coming across my path and I happen to see you, it will be your last.
Wow. Okay. Run scared, I guess. But seriously, we can shake our heads and roll our eyes. But, you know, these are the people that go up on rooftops and start shooting at political figures and commentators. So I hope the authorities in South Carolina, where this was recorded, are following up on that little tirade from that demented little child. That's kind of alarming. But that's where we are. For those of you who pay attention to such things, you know, we're kind of in a precarious state right now. The TSA, which is operates under the, so okay, it's the Transportation Safety Administration. I hate using too many acronyms, which operates under the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, has not been funded for a couple of weeks now, and that's wreaking havoc at the airports, at least until the president wisely sent in members of Immigration and Customs Enforcement to help the TSA run the security ops in these airports, and it made an immediate difference. But the other little gap in Department of Homeland Security operations is the fact that until recently, it didn't have a director, because Director Kristi Noem, as part of, she was a political fall woman. She was forced to resign and take another post in the Trump administration, which left an opening for this important job, director of the Department of Homeland Security. And ultimately, the selection by President Trump is Oklahoma Senator Mark Wayne Mullen. Now, for those of you who watch some of these excellent political programs, such as the Charlie Kirk Show and Steve Bannon's War Room, all of them available on streaming networks, we're very familiar with Mark Wayne Mullen because he is a frequent guest. He's a unapologetic patriot. A very interesting life story, not dissimilar to that of J.D. Vance, coming from very humble beginnings. J.D. Vance, the vice president of these United States. So Mark Wayne Mullen is named the appointee, and then he goes through the usual contentious confirmation process up on Capitol Hill, because the Democrats have to turn every Trump confirmation into a some sort of a, you know, witch hunt type operation. And wouldn't you know it, one of these Democrats has the audacity to use as a negative and a smear against Senator Mark Wayne Mullen that he does not hold a college degree. And as if that was disqualifying somehow. Now, mind you, he's a sitting United States senator, and they're going after one of their own. Well, this really inflamed the sensibilities of another character up on the Hill, Tennessee Representative Tim Burchett. Let's play clip three.
Hey, everybody. Tim Burchett. I've been reading a lot lately about folks fussing about Mark Wayne Mullen not having a dadgum college education. Sitting there thinking about that, and the arrogance of that is just beyond belief. I mean, there's a guy who, granted, we're not the best of friends. We've had our differences, but has nothing to do with his leadership abilities. You know, he left school, from what I understand, because his daddy got sick and he took over the family business. And he's, by all accounts, he's been unbelievably successful. Several other businesses, and he's got a mess of kids, and him and his wife, and they do a good job at raising them. I often go down local coffee shop around here, and I talk to some of the young folks there, and a lot of them have a college degree. Some of them have multiple college degrees. I just think the snobs in the intelligentsia these days, they are a little big for their britches. My dad didn't have a college education when he and his buddies went and saved the world during the Second World War. Literally, they saved the world.
Yes, they did, and that's a very excellent point that he makes there. And, you know, we mentioned earlier in the program the late Charlie Kirk, and Charlie Kirk did not attend a university, did not hold a college diploma. And when you consider how the educational industrial complex has become this bloated profit machine, charging parents and students these astronomical tuition fees, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in some cases to receive a piece of paper, we call it a diploma. And then they go out into the workforce and find that they don't know what they want to do, or they can't find a job in the field that they majored in. They end up, as he said, working at Starbucks, as Representative Burchett said. You go down there if you want to talk to some college grads, just go to a coffee shop and, you know, strike up a conversation with the barista, and you might find yourself talking to a PhD from time to time, and I'm not exaggerating, really. Of course, I avoid Starbucks like the plague. I believe that we should, if we're going to go to coffee shops, we should patronize our local coffee shops, and I make a habit of that. And you know, unlike the Starbucks where they're all brain dead, you know, at your local coffee shops you can get to know the people by name, and you come in and they know you by name, and it's sort of like Cheers, the old TV series, except it's not a saloon, it's a coffee shop. And you're drinking some coffee and you're eating a bagel and you're having a good old time. And that's what I recommend doing for your, you know, for your personal mental health and sanity. A reminder that coming up, we will be engaging in conversation with Andrew Dunn, the author of the Longleaf Politics newsletter, which you can find at Substack.com. He also is a recurring political columnist for the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer, which, of course, have a joint publishing operation. Andrew Dunn joining us to talk about the demise of State Senate President Phil Berger, defeated in his North Carolina District 26 primary race by Rockingham County Sheriff Sam Page. And if you want to look at a sheriff who came straight out of Central Casting, check out Sam Page. Nobody wears a cowboy hat and a pair of boots like this guy does. And now he is the Republican candidate for that state Senate seat in the fall. And, of course, he'll be the overwhelming favorite against whatever Democrat crawls out from under a rock to challenge him. But Andrew Dunn coming up later in the program. It was announced this week by the Trump administration that the 82nd Airborne right here in North Carolina is heading out to the Middle East to, I think it's really to clean up the engagement there, tidy it up, finish it off, and let everybody come home and leave Iran to be the sniveling subjects that they now are destined to become, subjects of the United States, and to leave the Strait of Hormuz once and for all in the control of the United States and our allies, and not in the control of the tyrannical Ayatollahs and merchants of death in Iran. So let's keep the members of the 82nd Airborne in our prayers. I was made aware in the past week that one of the members of our military who has been injured during these operations in the Middle East is actually a Fort Bragg guy, and he's now being treated for his injuries abroad and is expected to be coming back here to the area soon. And when that happens, we will potentially try to tell you more about his heroic activities as part of this operation. What is it? I'm drawing a blank. It's Operation Something over in Iran, and it's been, by all accounts, very successful. You wonder sometimes if the media can become any more deranged in its view of President Trump and his people. Well, the answer is yes. There is one who is even more deranged than ever before. He is a writer for the New Republic, which is a far-left rag. I guess it's more of a digital publication now, but at one time was known as a magazine, the New Republic. And they published this. It's got to be a 10,000-word piece by Matt Ford, and it's entitled "There Will Be No Post-Presidential Peace for Donald Trump." Subhead, the president and his allies will face impeachments, lawsuits, and maybe even The Hague, which of course is the International Court of Justice or something of that nature. So what is his point here? Well, he says that that basically he concludes that Donald Trump is emerging as a modern day walking and talking, living and breathing American king, similar to George III back in the at the dawn of the Revolutionary War, when we declared our independence and then you know, killed a lot of redcoats, and that was a lot of fun. But anyway, so Trump is now George the Third, and he is a dictator, and all these things that they keep repeating, figuring that if they say them often enough, we'll all believe it. He claims that Trump has transformed immigration and customs enforcement and the Border Patrol into a lawless paramilitary force that has besieged American cities, that Trump led the violent mob that aimed to overthrow the government on, wait for it, January 6th, 2021. And because of that, he thinks that it's going to be hell to pay for Trump and all of his inner circle when he leaves office. And he concludes, a jail cell may not await Trump, but after another 4 years of defiling the Republic, there will be no post-presidential peace for him or his top associates. There will be no lighthearted vacations to Europe for fear of trials beyond the Supreme Court's reach. There will be no adjunct job at some university or quiet retirement to some farm or ranch. There will be investigations. There will be depositions. There will be hearings. There will be whatever other measure of lawful justice can be provided. The fears that Trump voiced at the Kennedy Center last January that he would be impeached are very well founded. Dictators are always more fragile than they try to seem. If anything, the president has deeply underestimated his legal and political peril. Okay, Matt Ford, playing to his lunatic left-wing base. Our guest this morning is Andrew Dunn, author of the Longleaf Politics newsletter, which you can find at substack.com. Andrew is also a recurring columnist for the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer newspapers, and a longtime observer of, speaking of observing, of the North Carolina political scene. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning.
We appreciate your time, and I wanted to bring you on because, you know, there was a minor political seismic event here in North Carolina coming out of primary election day earlier this month, and after a period of counting and recounting and going, you know, following all the legal avenues. Longtime Senate President Phil Berger actually lost an election and did so by a mere 23 votes to Rockingham County Sheriff Sam Page. I guess the obvious question is how did that happen, and not how did he not find 23 votes, but how did he end up being in a tight race in the first place, which he ultimately lost? This 15-year Senate president, one of the most entrenched machine politicians in the nation, really. How did it happen?
It's a good question, and the simple answer is the casino plan. Your listeners probably remember back in 2023, Senator Phil Berger was the spearhead of a plan to put a couple new casinos around the state, including one in Rockingham County. But Senator Berger didn't really go through the normal channels that you're used to with something like this. There was not a whole lot of local public input. It was kind of a plan imposed from above. And it turns out the people of Rockingham County really didn't like that, and Sheriff Sam Page took advantage of it. So that's certainly a big part of it, but the real answer to why Berger lost here is broader than that. It's really about how Senator Berger lost touch with his voters. He spent so much time in Raleigh over the last two decades that the people back home started to feel that he forgot about them. And that's a problem right now, is there's a real broad dissatisfaction with government on both the right and the left, and it works against incumbents. You know, if you're not diligent about making the case that you are responsive to and actually working for your constituents, it can bite you. And it certainly did bite Senator Berger this year.
And what about the Sam Page factor? I remember hearing him speak when he was one of, I think, 11 people running for lieutenant governor back in that primary. And, you know, he's obviously a very charismatic figure, and he's been the sheriff something like 28 years. So he certainly is well known to the community in Rockingham County. What was his message, or what was his campaign success that allowed him to sort of pull off this incredible upset?
Yeah, I mean, Sheriff Page is not, well, he's better known now statewide now that he won, but he wasn't very well known statewide. And that's why he lost pretty handily in the lieutenant governor's race. But he's something of a local celebrity in Rockingham County, which makes up the base of this political district. And, you know, he won the lieutenant governor race. If you just counted Rockingham County, he would have been elected in a landslide there. And his message was pretty simple. It was, we the people. I mean, that was the simple phrase that he used again and again and again. I work for you, and that's my message.
And not only did he, you know, come into it as a clear underdog, he was never going to have the ability to raise the kind of money that Berger did. And yet, at the end of the day, that didn't really seem to matter.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And I think a big part of that is that anger is probably the most animating force in politics. You know, we're talking about a midterm primary, which is going to have lower voter turnout. It's really going to draw the people who are most politically engaged and have the most at stake. And that really worked in Sheriff Page's favor. I mean, the people who were most animated in this election were people who were mad at Senator Berger or supporters of Sam Page. You know, if you look at the actual numbers, the Guilford County portion of the district has more voters. And Senator Berger was really counting on that. He did perform a lot better in Guilford County. But when you look at the actual results, it was almost split 50-50 between Rockingham and Guilford, because the turnout in Rockingham County was just so much more robust than in Guilford. And it goes back to what I was just saying about the anger.
Mm-hmm. The outcome was big enough news that even the New York Times sent one or more reporters to cover the race and then the period of recounting that went on for a couple of weeks. And it's kind of dropped a bombshell in its reporting in that it reports that Senator Tom Tillis, our lame duck U.S. senator, along with some very wealthy potential donors wondering whether or not they should support Berger, got together on some kind of a Zoom call and concluded that it was time for Berger to go, that Tom Tillis actually led this revolt. Do you buy into that? Do you think that actually happened?
I don't doubt that it happens. I don't get the sense that Senator Tillis led the revolt. I think he saw an opportunity towards the end where, you know, the polling was coming out showing that Sheriff Page had a real shot. And he saw an opportunity to settle some old political scores. You know, I'm sure your listeners remember that Senator Tillis formerly was the Speaker of the House here in North Carolina, and there was clearly some bad blood going back to those days. So it's certainly notable that Tillis got involved here. I don't think it's quite the case that he was really the architect of it all, but I think he came in towards the end and saw an opportunity to help push Sheriff Page over the finish line.
Right. So now we have a situation where, of course, Berger and the Republicans in Raleigh have not been producing annual budgets like they used to, and they seem to have gone into sort of a stalemate in that part of their jobs. But what is left for Berger to do now on the way out the door? Is he just going to be the traditional lame duck, or do you think that he will have some kind of an agenda, maybe a retribution plan of some sort?
I certainly don't see Senator Berger acting like a lame duck. I think he's going to be extremely active over the remainder of his term. And I think it's going to show up in a couple different ways. There's more short-term impacts and then more medium and long-term impacts. You know, on the short term, I think Senator Berger is really going to be focused on his legacy, cementing his legacy, what he's done over the past two decades, and for good reason. And I think that's going to play out with the budget stalemate, which you rightly identified. You know, last year, the real sticking point on the state budget that kept a budget from being passed was really about tax policy. The House was worried about some of these revenue projections. You know, under current law, as North Carolina brings in more tax revenue, that triggers some tax rate reductions. And we're getting ready to hit some of those tax rate reductions. And there's real concern among the fiscal analysts that that is going to start eventually reducing the total amount of money that North Carolina, the state government, is bringing in. And, you know, there's a real discussion to be had over whether that's okay or not, or what the proper level is. But the fact is, North Carolina is a fast growing state. We are bringing in a lot more people every single day, and there are some real needs for us. So the House wanted to take a more cautious approach to tax rate reductions and make sure that there was enough money for things that the House wants to do, like, for example, raise teacher pay. There's a pretty compelling proposal out there to raise entry-level teacher pay up to $50,000 a year. I think it's pretty smart. I mean, that's a whole different discussion that we could have. But the Senate wanted to be more aggressive and move forward on some of those tax rate reductions. And between Senator Berger and Speaker Dustin Hall, there just never came to a resolution on that. Now that Senator Berger is a lame duck, I think what you're going to see is some movement on that. I think what you're going to see is Senator Berger is going to be more willing to give on the tax rate triggers, take some of the House's approach there, but he's going to want some things in exchange for that. And I think one of those things is probably going to be the rest of the money for the Children's Hospital in Apex. I think he sees that hospital as a big piece of his legacy. And I wouldn't be surprised in the next couple weeks to couple months that we see a deal hammered out there.
So then the next question becomes, just like, you know, UNC Chapel Hill fires Hubert Davis, and now all we've heard about for the last couple of days is who will be the next coach of the Tar Heels basketball program. Now the question becomes who will assume the mantle of leadership in the North Carolina Senate. Who do you think the obvious candidates are for that role?
Yeah, I mean, and there are some obvious candidates. I'm not convinced that the ultimate new Senate leader will be one of those obvious candidates. And it's worth pointing out before we get into it that the Senate Republicans have not had a leader other than Senator Berger since the early 2000s. I mean, even before Republicans took the majority in the General Assembly, Senator Berger was leading the Republican caucus there. Yeah. So, you know, the three names that come up the most in terms of who the new Senate President pro tem is going to be are all closely tied to Berger. There's Senator Todd Johnson out of Union County, Senator Michael Lee out of New Hanover, and Senator Ralph Heise out of Mitchell County, Spruce Pine specifically. All three of them are in current leadership in the Senate, and I think probably it would make sense for one of them to take the mantle on. What's left to be determined is whether there's going to be any sort of dissatisfaction in the Senate caucus more broadly. I really don't have a good sense of whether the Senate caucus as a whole is going to want to go for the continuity play and pick one of those three, or if they're going to want somebody completely different.
And then, of course, the ripple effect of that choice will be many of these other longtime members of the state Senate who hold various committee chairmanships. And I imagine many of them, including our senator here in Moore County, Tom McGinnis, are going to be wondering, you know, what kind of shakeups could be coming down the road depending on who replaces Berger. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair assumption. And I think the broader long-term question that's going to play out as the Senate is choosing its new leadership is whether we want the Senate or whether they want the Senate to serve as basically a series of long-term dynasties, or do they want to see the Senate leadership position move to more shorter stints? You know, what I hope to see happen is for the Senate to go back to the process that we really had for most of North Carolina history, in which there were term limits on leadership in both the House, you know, for the House Speaker and in the Senate. There was a general understanding, it was more of an unwritten rule than a written rule, that there was a term limit that you were going to get two terms in leadership and then pass the baton, essentially. And there was kind of a gentleman's agreement there that the leadership position was going to get handed back and forth between different regions of the state. You know, Eastern North Carolina was going to have a speaker or a Senate president pro tem, and then the western part of the state was going to have one. And we really got away from that in the 1980s. Once the governor got more powerful, the House Speaker position and the Senate president position got more powerful to kind of counteract that. But I do think there's real value in speaker term limits, and I hope that the state Senate will take this opportunity to bring those back.
And before we let you go, and we're talking to Andrew Dunn, who is one of the leading political observers in the state of North Carolina, the author of the Longleaf Politics newsletter. Andrew, of course, North Carolina is, whether we like it or not, one of the most important battleground states when it comes to national elections. We have a major midterm coming up later this year. There's been discussion that one of our congressional districts, because of redistricting, is actually vulnerable to be flipped to a Republican victory. But we're hearing so much about Republicans losing all these special elections and losing off-year elections in New Jersey and Virginia. Are there entrenched Republicans in North Carolina who are vulnerable to being defeated this November that we're not even thinking about?
Yeah, there are. And I think you raise a good point. And I think there definitely will be an undercurrent of dissatisfaction. I think Democrats do have a general advantage heading into 2026. And part of that is the larger political trend that we're seeing is that lower turnout elections now, and I think for the foreseeable future, are going to benefit Democrats. You know, for a long time, it was the opposite, that Republicans performed better. But now the new Trump coalition leans a lot more heavily on lower propensity voters, people who don't always come out unless there's a high stakes election. So when we get into 2026 midterms, I think it's not going to be quite as dramatic as what we're seeing in some of these special elections. I think those dynamics are just so unusual that I wouldn't fear that that's going to happen in 2026. But Democrats will certainly have an advantage. And I think where that's going to show up the most is potentially in the 11th congressional district out in the mountains. Democrats did nominate a pretty strong candidate in Janie Ager, who's more of your more old school, rural, populist Democrat. And I think the Republican representative out there is going to have a difficult time.
Is that Chuck Edwards, or is that some?
Yeah, that's okay. Chuck Edwards.
All right. Well, that's it. We'll keep an eye on NC11 then. Thanks for the heads up on that. Andrew, we thank you very much for joining us today on Taking Aim, and we will continue to seek your political wisdom in the months ahead. Thanks for calling today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, as always, we thank all of you for sharing Saturday mornings with us. For David Hensley, I'm Steve Woodward. We're back next Saturday exposing deception, corruption, and rhino imposters doing what we do best, taking aim.